George Vesey has spent most of his adult life writing about sports, first at New York Newsday and then at the New York Times, where he's worked since 1968 and is now a syndicated columnist. But Vesey took several years off from sports to cover religion and Appalachia for the Times. He's also collaborated on autobiographies with country music star Loretta Lynn, tennis champ Martina Navratilova, and baseball player Bob Welch. Vesey's new book, A Year in the Sun, is a journal that records his reflections on sports and sports journalism. He says he's never really enjoyed the chatty, smile-over-breakfast style of sports columnists.
Well, I always felt there was something a little bit more important to do than entertainment. I sort of came to entertaining later, but the first thing was like a bully pulpit, as Teddy Roosevelt said about the presidency. I thought there was a chance to say something really important, and the chatty Southwest, Southern, well, just a bunch of good old boys talking about sports, that never appealed to me.
What kinds of issues do you want to preach about?
Well, things I try and talk about are race and drugs and money and morality of sports, cheating in college. I mean, I've been accused of being preachy by someone who just left the sports writing business. The point being, I think that I try to look at the moral issue, try to say, well, what are some of the things that we should be talking about, not just who won the games and what kind of good old boys are playing them.
Let me ask you a New York Times question. You're a sports columnist at the Times. All of the writers at the Times, including the rock writers, have to say Mr. or now Ms. So the classic joke about the Times is that if you're interviewing Meatloaf, he becomes Mr. Loaf. You don't have to do that on the sports pages.
No, it's kind of refreshing, although we have to remember it when we're doing something that maybe jumped out to the front page. So we have to, someone that we normally goof on, and you know, he's George or Herr Steinbrenner or somebody, suddenly becomes, we have to dignify him as Mr. Steinbrenner. Even though I guess he, until he was pardoned recently, maybe we didn't have to call him Mr., but I think we did. I think everybody had to be Mr. on the front page.
How did you get the reprieve from that formality on the sports pages?
I think the point was, I don't know the history of it, and so I really can't speak for the paper, but it sort of makes an inner sense to me that a man or woman that's running around kind of sweaty I'm not sure that I'm in favor of the Mr. or Ms. or Mrs. and whatever on the rest of the paper. Although I suppose there's a certain dignity of the Times and so on. But if you had to lean one way or the other for sports, I'd rather not say, Ms. Graff then slid across and hit a smashing forehand that Ms. Sabatini couldn't handle. Or, Mr. Barkley. I mean, if we want to call somebody Mr. Barkley, let it be in jest rather than saying, Mr. Barkley then did a fake, stuck his hip into Mr. Oakley, who then responded. I mean, if we're going to call him Mr., it should be funny.
Yeah. You've been writing about sports on and off since 1956. How do you think the relationship between journalists and athletes has changed over the years?
I think it's changed. It's probably it's more honest, and the lines are drawn a little bit more. In the old days, when I even knew one or two sports, or some of us even made more money than the lowest paid baseball player.
Hey, those days are over, huh?
Well, those days are over. We were trying to figure out the other day that even on our wretched columnist salaries at the New York Times, we still make about what rookies or somebody with 1 year's experience makes in baseball. So it really kind of it kind of cuts the class lines. I mean, they know what was it, Joe Namath, when he was aggressing somebody in a bar a long, long time ago, called him a $200 a week creep, and the guy was offended because he said, and this is a sports writer, because he said, actually, I make $300 a week or whatever it was in those days. So the ball players know that we're X hundred dollar a week creeps, and it divides us. There is a difference.
Well, you started writing back in the days when Mickey Mantle was still playing, and you write in your book that you've always had a blind spot about Mantle.
Yeah, I would say it's a blind spot, and in the negative, he's become kind of a folk hero lately, and kind of surprised that he lived to be over 50, and now he had a book, and he's sort of cashing in on being this amiable, good old boy. But I can remember when he was hungover and showing up at the ballpark and sort of parading around the clubhouse bragging about what he'd done the night before, and you'd go over and ask him a question, and he'd kind of growl at you and say some very unpleasant things. So I just haven't been able to drop it. And I know that some of my colleagues have. Dave Anderson and Steve Jacobson of Newsday and other people write lovely pieces about Mickey Mantle, telling stories on himself. But I sort of remember the guy that sort of growled at me when I was younger.
Well, if Mickey Mantle did show up hungover and bragging about his exploits the night before, is that the kind of thing that you could write about, or was that off limits to journalists?
Hmm. I think that we at I came through Newsday. I really got my education as a journalist and as a sports journalist at Newsday. I think we were pretty good about at very least laying it between the lines. I mean, certainly if Mantle were bragging about, you know, well, Billy and I, we were out late last night. We didn't have any problem in dropping some of that stuff in there. Whether we ever raised the question, I think people's consciousness is so much higher these days. I know certainly mine is, since getting involved in writing about alcoholism and drug addiction from a more personal point of view. But in those days, at least at Newsday, we were involved in presenting the athletes the way they really were. And we sort of had an arrogant scorn. This is in the late 50s and early 60s, sort of the chipmunk generation that I write about, people at Newsday and the old New York Post, you know, the Leonard Schechter, Vic Ziegler New York Post, and the Philadelphia Daily News of Larry Merchant and Stan Hockman. We sort of felt that we were calling things the way they really were. We were being honest and a little bit analytical and psychoanalytic and all that. Maybe we were a little pretentious about it, but we felt that we were being realistic as opposed to the old, you know, what I call the breakfast morning, the chatty type of sports writer that tended to make them all into noble heroes. No names mentioned, maybe, but I think there were a lot of them who glorified athletes. And from the time I got into the business, I never felt I was doing that.
George Vesey is my guest, sports columnist for the New York Times and author of the new book, A Year in the Sun. What's an example of an ethical call you've had to make lately? You don't have to name names here, but in deciding what to print and what not to related to somebody's alcohol or drug problem.
Well, one of the things I go to quite a bit of length in the book about is 1986, hearing rumors, you know, the year that is covered in my book, that hearing rumors about Dwight Gooden, that he was just not himself that year, and he wasn't pitching quite as well. But of course, they're all with pitchers' arms. There's always a thousand reasons why somebody might be quite as good. But there were a bunch of other things that he was into that year. Little incidents of, you know, being late to something in spring training and giving a phony story and sort of not telling his own company the truth about how he'd sprained an ankle over the winter. There was a spat at a reservations counter, and we start to hear things from people, including somebody who's pretty well placed in the Tampa area, started to say, well, you know, police are sort of looking after him and people in Tampa think he's got a problem and so on. Those are things you can't write. You just can't write them because you do not want to defame anybody, and rightfully so. I mean, the Times is the most responsible paper that I know in the world. So we certainly didn't write it, but we did check things out. We had a couple of real good reporters who had tried to check things out, and nothing was quite clicking. But as the World Series was on, Gooden looked very bewildered to me on the mound in that fifth game up in Boston. And I seem to recall writing a column that this is not the young man, that the confident young man who wanted the ball. This is somebody who really isn't comfortable, who looks off into space, who just doesn't want to throw the ball. And the question to me was, and I certainly didn't raise, does he have other problems, except to say there was a history that had gone on that year. Well, toward the end of the year, Gooden was picked up. It was stopped for in his car and got into a real nasty brawl with some police, which is still going on. I mean, the legal ramification is still going on. The police have sort of agreed that some of them did not use the right methods. And it was a very tough call to make as to how much you can say about what suspicions are, as opposed to do you believe everything the police tell you, as opposed to if you're slightly out of control and if your car is wobbling around on a Saturday night in Tampa, you should maybe have enough sense to not get into it with the police on a dark road out in the middle of nowhere. If you're black and the police were mostly white, you get to the station house to where they can't use force on you. And I thought I approached that from the point of view of somebody who lived in the South, who was, I think, very sensitive to what it's like to be black in America.
But you got that, a pretty. That was a pretty controversial column.
It was a controversial column in that I got a lot of letters and phone calls in the following week from blacks and whites saying, you've overlooked what it's like to be black in America. You don't know what it's like. Police stop you from everything. And a lot of very rational people, including some friends of mine and colleagues, said, you don't know what it's like to be driving around. And I said, well, I do. I have black friends, and I've been out with them, and I hear stories. But in this case, there's more to it than we know. And who knows what the police were looking for? Who knows what happened out there? Why get into it with police? I couldn't believe that the police were looking to, you know, to beat up on Tampa's most famous athlete. Well, a week later, it turned out the hospital released it when maybe it shouldn't have, that his blood level was well above the legal limit for being drunk. And then a few months later, he tested positive for cocaine and went into a treatment center. And today, I hasten to add, after saying all this, that Gooden is a very mature and pleasant man. He has gone through a treatment center with a psychiatrist named Alan Lanz in New York, and he is a credit to himself, to his family, to the team, and to the center that he went to. So obviously things have changed for him. But looking back, my perceptions were more right than I knew, because the signals that I thought I was picking up on were the signals of somebody who was getting deeper and deeper into a habit that he wasn't going to beat by himself.
Mm-hmm. You write in your new book that you were shocked when you first started going on the road to follow mm-hmm. sports teams. You were shocked at the ease with which players picked up women. I was wondering if that kind of subject was off limits to you, or if it still is off limits to journalists.
Well, I would say strictly on a personal basis, to see people I knew, including some athletes that were married, how easy it was, how women hung around the hotel. I mean, I was only 22 or 23 from a, you know, sort of very, you know, very home-oriented background, and to see the ease with which that happened and the casualness of, so I said, yeah, okay, that was, but you didn't write it, you certainly didn't write it about people you knew. You maybe wrote about it in, the first person who wrote about that in any sort of specifics was Jim Bouton in Ball 4, which mm-hmm. he and Len Schechter did in 68 or 69, and Jim certainly didn't name names, but because he did say that players on the Yankees had played around, that there were parties, that women were pretty common, and, you know, he used pretty explicit terms, that Bouton became a pariah to the Yankees and has never been invited back to old-timers games. Now, the question is, do you name names of ballplayers? To me, it doesn't make any point, unless it becomes a public issue with someone like Wade Boggs being sued for palimony by the woman that he saw for 3 years out in California. Then it becomes an issue. Does it become an issue if you suspect that somebody's play is deteriorating? I think you find ways to say it without embarrassing him or his family. I think fooling around, that kind of behavior becomes an issue more when you're talking about national state secrets. I mean, a Gary Hart, I would worry about Gary Hart because it seems to me the man has a compulsion about women, and if he would have happened to become president, would you really want him getting a phone call late at night from the Secretary of Defense at the moment he was bringing in his third bimbo of the night into the White House? I mean, I think that's a problem. You know, John Tower, not that I really know what was proven or not proven, but I think that's a reasonable thing to ask. On the other hand, is it? Yes, it matters, and a lot of things matter. I think more to the point is not so much whether somebody's sneaking out, because it seems to me, from what I observed, an awful lot of ballplayers play well under that. I'd be more concerned these days. I ask myself about Pete Rose, because you've heard stories about Rose over the years. I mean, he obviously played around and wrecked a marriage with a, you know, rather interesting woman that he was married to the first time, and his behavior seemed compulsive in that area. But more to the point is his compulsion about gambling. Going to the track, being known that he bet a lot on legal things, going to the track, and I never heard the story, so I can't say that I'm guilty about it. But if journalists did hear stories 2, 3, 5 years ago, when it seems to me Rose's problem got worse, what's the obligation to write about a baseball player and or manager who has a problem? And I wrestle with that one. If I thought that somebody I knew now, from having gone through this Rose thing, of course nothing's proven that he did anything illegal or that he should be thrown out of baseball, but it certainly seems to me he has a problem with money and a problem with gambling, just a problem with how to live his life without always being thinking about money. That if you thought that about somebody that was in a position to influence a ball game, whether a player or a manager, at what point would you write about that? That would concern me more than somebody that maybe was out at night with somebody other than his wife.
George Vesey is my guest, and his new book is called A Year in the Sun. And I'm wondering if your year really breaks down according to the sports seasons.
Well, it, because football is sort of plunked in the middle of, in the dead of winter, is befitting such a gloomy and dreary sport. I start with a college bowl game and finish up with a college bowl game. But I think that we soon get to the resurrection, the renewal of life with spring training, and I certainly salute that the way many sports writers do, that we finally get out of the clutches of football and we get down and see some good, honest baseball players spitting tobacco juice and hitting their bats against their feet and all that good stuff.
Well, you say that football is still foreign territory to you. You don't like football or writing about it.
Yeah, I just never gotten football. I mean, it only happens for a couple of hours once a week. There's nothing to think about during the rest of the week. I mean, to go to the football camps, pro football camps during the week is to suffer terminal depression because the players are in their bunkers lifting their weights and gobbling their steroids, and you just don't. You just don't have any feel for them. The only time you have a feel for them is on Sunday when they come out with their helmets on a million miles away from you and they bang into each other and the ball is in motion for about 12 minutes a game. I mean, as you can tell, I've just never gotten it about football. I don't think I've ever written a good column or a story about it. I've never gotten a sense of a player making a personal decision or changing things or how one thing led to another. I mean, they go out and play the game, people get knocked down, people get their knees broke, and then the game's over and somebody won, but I just don't get it.
You'd like to see boxing banned?
Sure. I'm all for it. You want to join me in the? Actually, I'm not obviously not a petition person, given that I write, but and it's not a crusade that I work on day by day. But if I had the choice, I mean, if you gave me the button to push, I would push it, because to me it dehumanizes not only the people in the ring but everybody around. It encourages human beings to root for serious injury. The mini death, which is what a knockout really is a mini death, encourages people to root for that. They're not rooting for points. They're not rooting for a victory. They are rooting for the guy in the white trunks or the guy in the black trunks to knock the other man down, and they're rooting for the man to get up again and take it like a man, stick his head out there, and then get knocked out again. They want to see knockouts, but they also want to see a lot of action and a lot of hitting. And I think as society, you have a right to say what's over the line, that it's not only bad for the people in the ring, but bad for the people out of the ring. When we ban other things, we ban running red lights, and nowadays, any flight under 2 hours, that people can't pollute my lungs with their smoke, I think that's wonderful. I think we also have the right to say boxing isn't good for any of us.
Well, the first fight that you saw in the actual arena was, there was a knockout, and it was a particularly violent fight, and you think that might have had something to do with...
Well, I'm sure. I had avoided boxing up to that point. I mean, I just never gone near it. I'd seen Joe Louis train when I was a kid. I'd been around boxers. But to be 20, whatever I was, 23, 24, and to go see my first match, I'd done a piece with Carlos Ortiz, who was a real tough guy from New York, and I liked him. I mean, he was a lot of fun. I loved being out at the camps with him because it was fun to see him train and to sit around and his handlers. I liked all of that stuff. And when he got in the ring, to see him corner Flash Elorde, the way on a nature film, like you'd see the wonderful world of the tiger cornering the antelope in some valley somewhere. It was that way to watch Ortiz corner Elorde. And I must admit, sitting in the first row, I don't think I'm particularly wimpy about other things. I mean, I've played a lot of sports and know all about throwing elbows and knees and pushing people around, and even football. I wouldn't ban football. I always prefer not to have to watch it. But boxing to me was over the line for personal reasons. Of course, then I was 23. I really didn't come out for a ban on boxing for 20 years later for other reasons, when a bunch of combinations, I mean, that dreadful Tex Cobb, Larry Holmes fight, Arguello being pounded around by Pryor, and, of course, Duck Hoo Kim being killed in a fight with Mancini.
You know what I'm wondering? You were covering for, was it Newsday? You were covering the first boxing match that you actually went to see?
Actually, I was doing it for a magazine.
Oh, okay.
So I was doing a magazine piece, I think a sport magazine, on Carlos Ortiz. So no, I wasn't covering it as an expert.
Oh, okay.
Hardly. I was there.
So I was wondering if that would be an acceptable thing.
Well, you know, a lot of things we write about, the first time we ever write about them, we don't know anything. I mean, when I covered religion for 4 years in the late 70s, and I went into it knowing almost nothing about my own or any other religion. And yet, if you're a writer, if you're an observer, if you're a journalist, you can learn pretty quickly. No, I wouldn't have any problem covering it. If there's a sport that I've never covered, I wouldn't have any problem reading the rule book and asking a few questions and going out and covering it.
I'll bet that when you were on the religion beat that you got really different quotes than when you were on the sports beat.
yeah, really. I missed that part of it, because just about anybody you met in religion, unless they were hiding something. I mean, I once had a cardinal turn on me in a hotel corridor because I was sort of trying to pin him down on something, and I just happened to find him in this hotel corridor, and he sort of turned tail with his robes flowing, sort of ran from me, which I thought was kind of fun. But mostly people want to teach you. I mean, the rabbis, the priests, the nuns, the ministers, they want to teach you things. They had things on their mind. They would call you up, or if you ran to them, they would say, well, do you have an hour? Well, when you go up to a baseball player's locker and you say, well, how come that play happened a certain way? The player will say, what kind of dumb question is that to ask me? I mean, it's a different mentality. They don't think of themselves as teachers. They see themselves as performers, as doers, and they're not necessarily, I mean, some are, but not necessarily thoughtful people. So when you ask them a question about performance or strategy, they think, why don't you know that? You know, if you're covering this great game of mine in which I excel, why don't you know that? But obviously more educated, learned people understand that you ask a question to elicit an answer because you really do want to take in a bunch of information.
Were your breaks from sports writing voluntary?
I would say sure. In 1970, Gene Roberts, who was then the national editor of the New York Times, asked me to go to work for him on the national staff, to move from being a sports writer to go down to Appalachia. And I love the idea. They had to talk me into it a little bit in the sense of whether it would be good for my family. And it turned out it wasn't good for any of us on a family level. But it was a wonderful job, and I loved working for him and for Dave Jones, who succeeded him, because Roberts is now running the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's done a great job down there. But I love that job, and if anything could have taken me away from the... I'd sort of gotten burnt out as a sports writer in the 60s anyway, and not that I like the word sports writer, but as a shorthand, the 60s were so exciting, important, exhilarating, challenging, whatever you want to say, that to have the anti-war movement going on, the rock music, and the youth movement going on, and I was sort of like father of three, watching it from a little bit removed. On the other hand, I was very much involved in it, and when a chance came out at the tail end of the 60s to cover America, to get out and see what had been happening while I'd been in the ballpark in the 60s, I certainly jumped on it.
Well, did you ever feel like you were getting removed from life covering sports during the late 60s?
No,
when
mercy. The worst moment was in 69 when I went to cover what turned out to be an epic game, and one that we still write about, was the first exhibition game. The first time the Jets and the Giants ever met was an exhibition game in the Yale Bowl in the summer of 69. Of course, not much, and I was covering the Giants, and I guess maybe that's... covering the Giants in those days put me over the line about football, too. But being at that game, being in sweltering Yale Bowl on a Sunday afternoon, and knowing that Woodstock was taking place, whatever, 50 or 100 miles away, totally blew me out. I said, why am I here watching football fatties frying up their hamburgers out in the parking lots and watching all these people lurch in and drunk and acting, go team go, and all these overfed guys playing out in the field, when the people that I related to, for better or for worse, I mean, not that I related to the drug culture part of it, but the protest part, the music part, the youth, shaking off a lot of things from the 50s by the end of the late 60s, I related to that a lot, and I felt so out of place being at that football game.
So was that a turning point for you? Did you big decisions after that?
Well, I don't know that I've ever made a big decision. They sort of happened, but I think it was sort of an epiphany of feelings anyway, of recognizing that I was so out of touch. And then, of course, in the Cambodian, the Kent State business, I mean, I was covering a game one night when the Cambodia invasion, and it looked like there was going to be a call-up of troops. And I remember writing a story about two Yankee ballplayers, Roy White and Stan Bonson, talking about being afraid that their units were going to get called up. And I wrote a whole story about while all this stuff was happening out in the world, it even touched the ballpark, where the two players who were pivotal in last night's Yankee game, all they could talk about afterward was whether their units were going to get called up. And I remember one of the old elephants at the Times tried to give me some answer. You can't write about things like that in the sports pages. And I said, well, of course I can. These two guys are talking about that. That's what's on their mind, so therefore I can write. I'm just not a columnist, not an editorial. This is what was happening last night at the ballpark. And it did get in, but there was sort of a mentality. My head was in a little bit different place than a lot of people I was seeing, certainly in the sports section, and I was very glad to get out of it at that time. And I stayed out for 10 years, and I only went back when one of my favorite editors ever, Arthur Gelb, who was now the managing editor of the Times, he came up to me and said, why didn't I go back into sports to sort of write features? And he never really mentioned the column per se. That came later.
George Vesey is my guest, sports columnist for the New York Times and author of the new book, A Year in the Sun. What sports treat journalists the best, and does that make a difference in how much you like to cover the sport?
Treats a... an ambiguous word. Let me put it this way. There's no sport that treats journalists better than the National Football League,
mm-hmm.
for parties, for having shrimp as you walk mm-hmm. into the freeload before the Super Bowl, for making things easy for you. I mean, they run a good ship. I still goof on them. Why? Because I don't like their sport and I don't like their pretentiousness. But other sports that I like, I mean, I like to watch hockey, and they don't really have much of a clue about how to organize press conferences and public relations, and that really doesn't matter. To go to the World Cup of soccer, where there's almost no conveniences and almost no information, still, I think it's a great game, and I love to go to it, even knowing that I probably will never get to be able to talk to the athletes, that you probably won't be able to get the starting lineup until after the game is players are actually on the field, that they just don't believe it. I mean, it's kind of a worldview that journalists are. bribable and therefore swine, which a lot of, you know, may be the truth in Europe and in Latin America. I know somebody once told me that when athletes came over from Latin America or Europe, he had to say to them, running a soccer club in the United States, look, we don't pay these guys. They really write what they want, and if you talk to them and talk to them honestly, in fact, they'll represent what you have to say. So the general manager had to set them straight that things were different in the United States. But I would say that every sport is different. I mean, you do go in, yes, there is a freeload room where you can eat before a game, which I look upon as, you know, the least of the problem if you tip copiously. Information is there. American sports are pretty well organized to give you information, but, you know, do they do anything else for you? You know, the Yankees have been sending me a gift every Christmas for about the last 10 years since I went back into sports, and every year I have to schlep back into the office and give it to our purchasing department and say, please send this back up to Yankee Stadium. I want not only are we not allowed to keep the present, but I don't even want to even think about it because I want the emotional freedom of ripping Steinbrenner the next time he does something dopey.
Well, do you think most of the journalists send back the gifts?
Yeah, I think so.
Then why do they send them? Why do they keep sending them?
Well, maybe some don't. But I think it's just the idea of a little gift for you boys and girls out there, you know, just Uncle George in the counting house being nice, you know, and you know, we always kind of open it up and we look at it and say, well, what are we giving up this year? But I mean, it's giving up nothing because it's not mine. It doesn't belong to me. Somebody might even call it a bribe. But those things do go on. I mean, from the glimmer that we get at the Times, and the Times has very strict policy, and so did Newsday, where I worked before. From the glimmer that I get, I mean, I have to assume that some of that stuff goes on. I really don't want to know about it.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us a little bit about your work. Thank you for your time.
And thank you for your interest.